Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Welcome back to the virtual studio, and I'm thrilled to be hosting today's episode. I think I'm getting all of the alphabet ones. We try and take it in turns, but they've all fallen my way. And I'm trying to say this like Pete does. L to P of property.
So you were a poet and you didn't know it, Kate. Very good.
How are you both?
Very well, thanks, Kate.
Very good, thank you, Kate. Very good indeed.
Well, we're moving through the alphabet, and I was pretty excited to have a crack at the very last letters, and we've managed to flesh out all of these series, so we'll have them coming in future episodes. But today it's L to P. So, Dave, I'm going to start first up with you because L is for LMI.
So lenders mortgage insurance, when you borrow above 80% of the value of a property or the combined value of properties, you then have to pay an insurance which covers the bank, not you, but you have the privilege of paying for it. So why do you pay lenders mortgage insurance? Well, the bank perceives you to be at a higher risk because they have less equity, and should property values reduce and you don't have the ability to meet your repayments, the bank has some risk of losing money if they had to foreclose on your property and sell it. So that's why they get the insurance to cover off against any costs. But it's a price most first-time buyers have to pay unless they have significant assistance from their parents.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about LMI. How expensive is it?
It's quite expensive. It depends on the loan-to-value ratio. So some examples here, and it also depends on the loan size. So the larger the loan size and the larger the percentage of the property value, the higher the rate of mortgage insurance. So at one end of the scale, if your loan's under $300,000 with one lender and your loan-to-value ratio is only 80 to 81%, you'll pay 0.475% of the loan amount. But that's the lower end. Whereas if you were borrowing $750,000 to a million and you're borrowing 94 to 95%, you would pay more than 10 times the proportionate premium. You would pay 4.6% of the loan amount as an LMI premium versus, just to recap, 0.475%. So that's 10 times. And plus, it's a bigger loan size. So, you know, that's on a $1 million loan, that's $46,000 you're paying versus on a $300,000 loan at a loan-to-value ratio of 81%, you're only paying about $1,400.
Yeah. Now, it's calculated based on an algorithm or a matrix, really, and all of these factors are taken into account. Dave, how do people pay lenders mortgage insurance? Where does the money come from?
Well, you can borrow it, and you know, so you can have your loan to value ratio plus borrowing the mortgage insurance. But at the end of the day, you know, it comes out of your pocket, and you've got to consider it a cost, in essence, like stamp duty. You've got your purchase price, and then you've got other purchase costs, and lender's mortgage insurance is one of them. But you can finance it.
And are there different mortgage insurers out there, or is it just one?
No, there are different mortgage insurers out there. The prices do vary from lender to lender, so it is something to look at when you're making your lender selection choice, the cost of the premium, if you have flexibility and options with different lenders.
And sometimes you get applicants out there who are eligible for a higher threshold, so they don't have to pay LMI until they're at 90% instead of 80%. What types of individuals usually benefit from that, Dave?
Yeah, so if you're a lawyer, Medicare professional or a tax accountant generally are the professionals who get to not have to pay mortgage insurance up to 90% of the value of a property, which is a pretty big benefit. for those professionals. There's not a lot of lenders who will provide that option. There's a number of the majors who will. It may also depend on your income. So there can be a threshold for not only your profession, but for example, you need to earn over $150,000 a year, potentially.
And Pete, obviously this strikes first home buyers more than other types of borrowers, and it can be quite alarming if young borrowers aren't prepared for this. What are some of the things that parents can do to eliminate or reduce LMI?
We can go to the bank of mum and dad.
Yep.
Or my personal example is I said to my kids, I'll go dollar for dollar on their deposit. So if they come up with $25,000, I'm happy to gift them $25,000. Some use a guarantee, like guarantee another security. But if we could put some numbers on it, so I've looked at, say, a first-home buyer, and this is in South Australia. So they want to buy a property that's $500,000. They need a minimum of 5%, which is 25%, right? However, there are other costs because we got stamp duty. So to buy that $500,000 house in South Australia is approximately $21,000. But because you've only got a 5% deposit, your lender's mortgage insurance is an additional $18,000. And I can hear this, you know, this astonishment out there amongst our listeners. I'm not going to pay $18,000 if I don't have to. Well, if we work out the $25,000 deposit cash that you have, you need another total $45,000 upfront costs. So you need $70,000. If you want to avoid lender's mortgage insurance, you need a $100,000 deposit plus the $21,000 stamp duty. So spend $70,000 to buy the $500,000 home, or wait and spend $120,000 to buy the $500,000 home. But if you wait, so that's an extra $50,000 cash that you need. You've got to ask yourself, how long is it going to take for you to save $50,000? If the average income in Australia is $75,000, that probably nets out to $60,000. So if you only earn $60,000 cash, how long is it going to take you to save $50,000 of it? 2 years? 3 years? Well, I've got some news for you. That $500,000 home will not still be worth $500,000 in 2 years or 3 years' time. So in my opinion, and again, this might be my bias coming in, which is what we talked about in the previous show. In my opinion, LMI is just doing a cost. It's just a cost of doing business,
yep,
especially for an investor because it's tax deductible.
Yeah, it's That's an enabler. Opinion. I agree with you. Yeah. It's totally an enabler, but there are things that people can do to manage it and to maybe reduce it, considering how much savings they're moving forward with, what sort of prices they should consider. And as Dave said, talk to their strategic mortgage broker and get a really good idea up front about what it looks like and how they can fund it. Now, we're going to move on to M. M is for mortgage. And there are
To me, even though I came up with this, it looks like it's the Dave Johnson show here because it's all about finance. M is for mortgage, N is for negative and neutral gearing, O is for offset accounts, P is for positive gearing. How about if I just go and get a cup of tea and then I'll come back to say goodbye?
No, don't you worry. I'll keep some questions for you.
I'll keep it short and sweet, Pete.
No, not at all. You are the font of all knowledge, Dave. You are the font of all finance knowledge.
Absolutely.
Of all finance knowledge.
Not.
So, Dave, what are the critical components of mortgage?
We talk about the top six mortgage strategies. You've got offset optimization, the bank's greatest invention, money management, so making sure your banking and money management system interconnects with your lending structure, optimizing your tax deductions. You can only do that through your mortgage and understanding how to do that effectively. Your mortgage is your biggest debt in life, so it's the obvious place to start focusing on how you can manage risk through your mortgage. Also, if you plan to accumulate a property portfolio from the moment you settle on a property, or beforehand, really, you want to get your strategy right to understand how you can maximize your ability to hold your existing properties when you accumulate future properties. And then your repayment strategy also has a huge impact on being able to achieve these other five strategies that I've just touched on. Now, I haven't really explained how those strategies work, but, you know, high level, they are the six core mortgage strategies that we help our clients understand so they can create wealth, manage their risk and accumulate properties. But as this is Pete's episode, I will...
not at all. I'm not that precious. Actually, I'm glad that Kate asked you that question, because my answer was going to be, well, the critical components of a mortgage are the interest that you pay, the amount that you borrow, and the term of the loan. And that was it. But you've answered it much more comprehensively. And you're right, mate. There are, and I agree. I think offset accounts is the eighth modern finance wonder of the world. We are one of the very few countries in the world that have it. And I would strongly encourage all of our listeners, don't just, again, this is from personal experience, don't just look at what's the cheapest interest rate. Look at what other extras you can get. And if that loan comes with an offset account, seriously think about it.
This has just really turned into alphabet soup. You've jumped to O.
I have too. Sorry.
I love it. Well, let's delve into N, negative and neutral gearing. And I love this because so many people don't understand gearing. And gearing and cash flow are two different things. So, Dave, what is negative gearing?
So negative gearing is simply when the holding costs and expenses of an investment are greater than the income earned. It's called negative gearing because the income you've earned is actually in negative territory relative to the expenses that you're able to claim as a deduction. Now, on a property, the primary one often is the interest. Then beyond that, you know, you've got repairs and maintenance and other factors that you're able to claim a deduction on. Now, a lot of people think negative gearing in and of its own accord is a positive thing, but it's not. It means your investment is running at a loss, and any tax deduction is giving the government $1 to just get your tax rate back in return. So even if you're on the highest tax rate, you're only getting 47 cents back. You know, the argument that people make is whether you should be able to claim the interest on investments, and particularly property investments. And that's what the Labor government were talking about abolishing. So simply put, negative gearing is when you're making a loss from a cash flow perspective on an investment.
And getting a tax favour, getting a tax break.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
So negative cash flow means that when everything is taken into account, your net position is that you've lost some money. You've got negative cash flow. You can have neutral or positive cash flow in a negatively geared asset, which means that you're getting back enough from the tax man to tip you into positive cash flow territory. But the problem with negative gearing is that when you've got an asset that is delivering you a lot of negative gearing, that, as you just said, Dave, you're giving away a dollar to get however many cents back based on your marginal tax rate. But depreciation is another tax benefit as well. And often it's depreciation that can get a negatively geared asset over the line with positive cash flow. But if the depreciation is high, it means that the land to asset ratio is low. So it means the property's ability to grow is a bit hampered. And it's not a fair thing to say that every single brand new property won't perform, because there are some that have done very well because that suburb has done very well. But when contrasted to something with a greater land value content, it's underperformed. So this is a murky area for a lot of people because they get it confused. And I always think negative gearing is a positive for an investor if they've got the right property, if they've got a performer. When it's not so good is when they've chased the tax benefits and they've selected an underperforming asset.
From a capital growth perspective.
That's right. Yeah, what's the point? And there are four things I look for when it comes to property investing that can make for a successful journey. One of them is capital growth. Another one is the rental yield that you've determined you need or want, because we've all got cash flows that we're trying to work to. Another one is tight vacancy rates. It's no good having a property that you think sounds really good if you haven't got a tenant in there for many weeks of the year. And then the last one is the tenant experience. If it's a headachey property, it doesn't matter how well its performance is going, if it's giving you a headache, then that's impacting your life and your happiness. So there's a lot to good selection outside of just cash flow and gearing.
Yeah, and the point on depreciation is a really good one as well, because a lot of people aren't aware, but you actually pay capital gains tax on the depreciation. So although you do get that tax break whilst you own it, you actually pay capital gains tax when you sell based on how much depreciation you've claimed on the building during the time of ownership. Another factor too, because often one of the ways that the Spruikers will sell new property is obviously, as you've just touched on, Kate, to show how it's not very expensive because of the depreciation often is what makes it into being neutrally geared. For example, where your cash flow meets your costs after tax, but often that means when it's a new property, that's when you're getting your best rental yield. And so the property's dating quite rapidly. There's new properties going up nearby. Usually whenever you buy a new property, there's usually more space and buildings going up down the track or more estates being built nearby. So the actual yield is often reducing. So it's not only looking at this ideal scenario of you're claiming the highest depreciation, which does reduce year on year, but also often your rent's reducing as well. And that's the type of thing that a budding investor probably isn't aware of, as well as paying capital gains tax on the depreciation at the end.
And investors need to be careful because tax rules change. Like 5 years ago, you could claim the kilometres you travelled to inspect your property, do some work on your property, can't do that anymore. Just a few years ago, you could claim, say, carpet. So the carpet in the house, let's say it was 5 years old, 3-4 years ago, you could claim the depreciation on that. But now you can't, unless you've actually paid for that carpet to go in, you can't depreciate it. So tax rules can change, but the one thing that won't change is what you bought and where you bought. So if you can get that right, and these other little things around it might change, tax rules and tax incentives, at least you've got the main part of it correct, which is the type of property you bought and where you bought it.
This just reminds me of an evening in town that I had with Pete Wargent and Mike Mortlock. We got together on budget night. And they were so animated. It was a really, it was very fun catch up anyway. I love those guys. But seeing them get so excited about all of these tax changes, and to your point, Pete, there were a lot of them and we had to go through them one by one. And Mike put out some really good information and articles. So anyone who's wanting to know a little bit about the tax changes, Mike Mortlock, a little shout out at MCG, Quantity Surveying.
And just a bit more on this topic, it's probably just another good example of get the big rocks right.
Yeah.
And the big rocks are the dirt, the location of the dirt, and then the dwelling overall. And yes, you absolutely optimize your tax deductions, but don't buy a property to optimize your tax deductions. Get that right after buying a quality asset.
Completely. Well, we'll leave that ugly letter in the alphabet soup alone and we'll head straight into offset accounts. Now, Pete, you touched on this, and Dave, we've put together some episodes specifically about offset, but what's a key takeout if I'm giving you a short elevator pitch today?
Offset is the tool that greases the wheels of the rest of your mortgage strategy. So it can allow you to optimize tax deductions, optimize the ability to hold properties, you know, convert a home into an investment property without having to sell it, manage risk because you're still reducing interest without having to make additional repayments by building up your buffer, the maximum amount. And the only time anyone's ever got financial, ultimately the worst kind of financial trouble is when you've run out of money. So, you know, the offset account really feeds all the rest of the strategies with your money management system. You know, some lenders will allow you to have multiple offset accounts, so you can ensure each of your buckets is offsetting interest on your home loan. If you have a home loan and if you only allowed one offset with that lender, well, make sure it's what we would call your grow offset, where you have most of your funds in it. So the key with offsets is it does grease the wheel of the rest of your strategies. And so it's understanding how to properly utilize it to make sure it does.
Fantastic overview. I love that analogy. Now we're up to our last letter out of the five letters. P is for positive gearing. And obviously there's a relationship between positively geared, negatively geared, and neutrally geared. Pete, I'm going to get you to chat about this one.
Sure. So I just did some rough calculations there. So positive gearing is where you've borrowed money, but still the rent is more than all the expenses. And in the end, the key phrase there is, in the end, you want your property to be positively geared. Now, at the beginning, when you have the highest debt, which is generally your largest expense when you first buy an investment property, it's probably going to be negatively geared. But in the end, as your rents grow fast, your debt drops, hopefully relatively quickly, even though your expenses are increasing, the rate of decreasing your debt, the rate of increasing your rent is greater than what's happening to your expenses. Just to explain it, just using some numbers. So in year one, you might be getting $20,000 in rent and $25,000 in expenses. So that's minus $5,000. In year 10, your rent might be $30,000 and your expenses $30,000. So now we're neutrally geared. And in year 20, your rent could be $40,000 and your expenses $35,000. So you are positively geared. So really, after year 10, you are positively geared.
You're paying tax.
Yeah.
What a fantastic outcome.
I think that's a lovely problem to have.
Yeah. Me too.
So just keep in mind that in the end, your property should be positively geared, because some people's plans for retirement is to live off the rent. Well, the only way you're going to live off the rent is if your rent is way more than all your expenses. And one way to drop the expenses significantly is to pay off the debt. And that takes time.
It does indeed. Now, there are a few things that can happen that will allow us to be positively geared earlier rather than later. And we've all been sitting through this low interest rate environment, so we all know what I'm alluding to. We saw with every consecutive rate cut, our portfolio was getting closer to overall cash flow positive. And it was really interesting, because you can work hard at getting rid of the debt, you can work hard at improving the property and getting higher rents, or you can target areas that have stronger rental yields. But when you have low interest rates or reducing interest rates, that definitely has a direct impact on the timeline for you to switch your property or properties over to positively geared. Now, Pete, you would have encountered this, and particularly with newer style dwellings, because you get a higher rental for something that's nice and new and shiny. What's your experience been over the last few decades where you've been an active investor and you've seen interest rate movement?
So certainly, you know, I concur with what Dave said. When your property is brand new, that's when you're going to get the highest rent, because generally when I develop, I keep. What I find is the rate of growth in the rent in my new properties is nowhere as near as great as the rate of growth in the more established properties. To counteract that is the great depreciation benefit you get. But the other thing that I've found, you know, and I've been investing now for over 30 years, is I have never seen as much cash in my account. That's just to say there's millions of dollars. I'm just saying, compared to the past.
Party at your house.
Yeah. One, because interest rates are so low, but I'm paying interest on a lot less debt. You imagine 29, if I bought all of my properties 30 years ago, right? 30 years ago, my debt was at its highest and interest rates were like double digit, right? Fast track now, debt is way lower than it was and interest rates are 3%. You know, your debt, if you're paying 3% on your debt compared to paying 15% on your debt, mate, it's obviously got to help your cash flow. So really for me, investing is the long game, and if you've got patience, it does reap a lot of rewards.
Indeed. Now, the type of interest repayment schedule that you're working to also plays a role in this. And Dave, you talk to your investor clients about either interest only or principal and interest. And for a little while there, we didn't get a lot of choice. When the regulators really clamped down, it was very, very hard to get an interest only loan. But also with the frequency of people's willingness to refinance, to reset things, to look at another lender or to reset the debt amount, that certainly carries some weight as well when it comes to flicking over and becoming positively geared. Because you can all of a sudden look at your offset balances, and when the time is right, talk to a professional who might completely change the strategy and get rid of some of that debt as well. And you might lose some of your offset savings, but depending on what age and stage of life you're at, that's also another quick switch that flicks you from neutral into positive or negative into positive.
Yeah, absolutely. Your repayment strategy is a critical component of your mortgage strategy and your wealth creation and risk management strategy and optimizing your tax deductions until you've paid off all of your non-deductible debt, and then starting to focus on reducing the deductible debt to transition yourself to being in a much stronger cash flow position as you head into retirement. And in an ideal world, you don't have to divest, sell any of your existing properties or potentially even downsize. But it's very common for people to sell at least one asset as they're transitioning into that stage of life. Mm. And certainly your repayment strategy is a critical component of your overall, you know, property plan and financial strategy. And it's got to suit your stage of life and your debt position.
That's right. I think when we're talking about how we want to retire and what our property strategy is, and there's no right or wrong here, some people like myself buy and hold. I'm going to hold them all to the end, pay them all down and enjoy the rents and not sell any. And then, as you've just said, some people will sell an asset and put the money into a different asset class. And we've got to be really mindful about not only when we'll be positive cash flow, but when the debt will be retired if we're adopting that buy and hold strategy, because you can retire and still carry debt if it's positively geared. But it means that you can't grab all of that rental income because you're still meeting your repayment obligations. And Pete, you touched on that. I think beyond just working out when we'll be paying the debt off in full, we also need to recognize when it will switch over and become positively geared so that we can start making some vague plans about retirement dates.
So, Dave, can I ask you a question? And this is about, do the banks consider the positive or the negative gearing? So let's say there's two scenarios, or there's a few scenarios. One is, after all expenses, you're $50 positively geared. The other one is you are $50 negatively geared. So one puts you in positive territory, the other one puts you in negative territory. Do they look at that differently than if you bought them two properties and one was $200 positive geared and $100 positive geared?
No.
Does that matter to them?
It just sort of boils down, what's your overall aggregate tax deductible debt and your overall aggregate rent? And then that goes into the serviceability calculation. And they're really actually very conservative when it comes to rental income. So, and because there's also, they assess it on the benchmark assessment rates, which are now 3% above at least what you're paying. It's surprising how little of an impact rent has on your borrowing capacity.
Well, very surprising for me, because as our listeners might know, I'm working part-time at uni. And so even though the banks love my uni salary, I earn much more in rent than I do from uni. Well, if I wanted to borrow more, I should worry about increasing my salary at uni rather than increasing my rent, because they discount so many things, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, let's discount the vacancy rate. Let's discount the expenses. This might happen, this might happen, this might happen. And it's just huge.
Yeah, they'll start by generally nowadays taking only 75 to 80% of your rent. So there's already 25 of that gone, and then they bump up the interest rates by a few percent, and all of a sudden, even if you are positively geared from a borrowing capacity, but it's negative. It's actually reducing your borrowing capacity.
Yeah. I remember those good old days where they take actual. I liked that.
Yeah. Well, that's where the second tier lenders come in handy.
Yeah, right. Very
Some
much so.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, L to P, it's been a lot of fun catching up with you too. And I look forward to when we get to cover off Q to T. That will be into February, I think, looking at our schedule. But I hope our listeners have enjoyed this one. And more importantly, I hope our listeners are enjoying a bit of a break and some nice sunshine and just getting a chance to, you know, chill and recharge.
Hope they're having a great January.
Yeah. Now, have you
great summertime.
Got your gold nuggets on hand?
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Dave, you go first.
Okay. So my gold nugget is actually going to be something Pete said. So one of Pete's, almost his first sentence when he was talking about his rentals and properties ownership was he said, his new properties, and he hasn't bought new properties from someone else. He's only kept them when he's developed. So that's a really important distinction. But the rents haven't grown that much after he's built them. because they'll get the most when they're new. And then he went on to say, but his established properties have grown in rent significantly. That's an important distinction for our listeners to understand. And it's also just another area where people can get confused by the yield. So a new property might have a higher yield at the point of purchase, and that's the percentage of the value of the purchase price. It might be 5%, for example, whereas an established property might be 3%. But that 3% established property is likely to grow in rent at a much faster rate than the new property would, even though its percentage as a value of the purchase price on the day of purchase is much higher. So if that sounds confusing, re-listen to what I just said. But this...
Hit the back button.
Yeah, rewind. But this is actually one of the key distinctions that people do get confused about when it comes to property and why it's so hard to differentiate and delineate between capital growth and rent. But just again, as Pete said, his established properties have grown in rent significantly more than a new property.
Nicely said. Pete, over to you for your gold nugget.
Right. So I got three quick ones because the L to P of property is mainly about finance. So far as LMI is concerned, I've said this before on the show, to me it's just a cost of doing business. Rather than waiting to save that 20% deposit, in the meantime property prices are going up, you're going to have to save much more than you thought. So don't hesitate to pay LMI. Your mortgage, unlike I thought, it was all about interest, how much you borrow and the term. Again, go back, rewind, listen to what Dave said. There is far more to the mortgage than those three components. And the offset account, that's the eighth modern wonder of the finance world.
Well, you know, Pete, back when you were first getting loans, that's all there was pretty much to mortgages. Yep. You know, like the offset only came into play probably 15, 20 years ago. There wasn't all the tools we have and flexibility back then. It was really just those three factors. Back in the, I won't say back in the olden days. I'll just say back.
Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. That's right, though.
Well, I think the most one tiny little nugget. I know I'm not up for a gold nugget, but we can't confuse redraw and offset. So if you're not certain about the difference between them, speak to someone who can absolutely tell you and walk you through it so that you understand why they're so very different.
Very true. Great way to finish off there, Kate.
Great tip, Kate.
Good to see you guys. We'll see you next week.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about making independent property decisions, listen to episodes 4, How to Develop Your Own Property Plan, Start with the End in Mind, episode 35, Emotional Decision Making, number 5 of the top 7 critical mistakes, episode 53, Diversification 101, How and Why to Plan for Diversification Within Your Property Portfolio, episode 94, The Winner's Curse and How to Avoid It, and also episode 129, What is Contrarian Investing and How Can You Make It Work for You?
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, It's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.